Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 234, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1978.
I can't believe you just said it. You didn't sing it, man.
Oh.
Sergeant Pepper's
I think because it was reprised about 12 times. In the first 10 minutes. I was looking at my watch going, good God, I cannot take this chorus of the song I previously loved that's now almost dead to me because it's been just, they laid it to waste and ruin.
Well, I gotta preface this by saying that this movie was an infamous flop. It came out in the tail end of the 70s. It was produced by Robert Stigwood, who previously had prior success with two of the biggest musicals ever.
Hair? Well, I think even one of them, that's for sure.
Well, Grease was another.
Yeah.
And he also produced Saturday Night Fever, which was like a quasi-musical with the Bee Gees. So, you know, that's probably how the Bee Gees came on board to this piece of shit. But this was just a wrong-headed concept in every form and fashion. And as somebody who, at one point in his life, I still love the Beatles, don't get me wrong. I'm just not a fanatic like I used to be. When I was in high school, I can honestly say that I ate, lived, breathed, slept, practically shit the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I had a friend in high school. We used to have games during like spares and lunch hours as to who was the biggest Beatles fan. And we would come up with games like, okay, every letter of the alphabet, write down a Beatles song and see who could do it quicker and that sort of thing, right? Or we would try and stump each other with trivia. So I worship the Beatles. I mean, I listen to them as much as I used to, but I still listen to them. Many artists have covered their songs, some with some degree of success, some with they basically fell flat on their face. This is a really mixed bag in terms of the covering, but beyond that, the movie itself is just terrible. And before we get into it, again, I love musicals. I loved, for example, we love Xanadu. We love The Apple. We love wacky, weird, wrong-headed musicals. You know, we find so much entertainment out of it. This was interminable. This was an interminable movie. From practically minute one to the end, I didn't know if I could make it through. I was ready to tap out.
And what's also interesting is the multivariate levels by which you can criticize this film. You would think, okay, this is terrible. That means the music is terrible, which it is. It's overwhelmingly terrible.
When you say the music is terrible, the original songs are great. You're not criticizing the Beatles. Because every song in this is a Beatles song sung by a motley assortment of characters. Some of the renditions are terrible. Some are not bad. In fact, I think some of the most unorthodox singers, i.e. George Burns, I think he acquitted himself well. I thought Alice Cooper acquitted himself well. Aerosmith did. But Pierre Frampton, the Bee Gees, the lady that sang or played Strawberry, and sang my all-time favorite Beatles song, Strawberry Fields Forever, and just destroyed it. Mm-hmm. It was so bad. So the music is terrible because they're not doing justice to the originals at all. They're spitting in the face of the originals.
Oh, for sure. But yeah, the story is unintelligible and terrible. The set design is terrible. Like, it's set in a town that looks like a Potemkin village of MGM Studios. It really is a backlot that it looks like something you'd see at, like, you know, Gilmore Girls or some show on Fox or God knows what. It's the same gazebo, the same stupid town.
The same town square. That's
the
all it
same
is.
Square, And so the laziness that went into this, and then the fact that they had the nerve to have this overarching anti-commerce, anti-cash-in, anti-mana, anti-moolah theme going through it. Like, oh, you know, the evil record company is looking
played
for a cash grab.
Played by Donald Pleasance.
Yeah.
So that was nice, although he didn't really have any words of dialogue.
He sang a wee bit, but I mean...
And that wasn't bad. He did I Want You, She's So Heavy, which went on and on. And that was terrible.
Oh, my God.
Pleasance's portion of it was pretty
cool. It was unpleasant.
I love that song.
Yeah, the arrogance to accuse an industry of a cash grab when this is start to finish a grotesque cash grab.
Agreed.
This made... not a lick of sense.
Okay, well, let me just say a couple things in response to what you just said. The first thing you're talking about, and the town, it's called Heartland. Heartland, USA. So it's supposed to represent every
town. The Heartland, you mean? Is that what it represents? The Heartland of America? Yeah. And it's called Heartland, you say?
Exactly.
Wow, that is amazing.
Talk about
it's
being,
so multi-layered.
I know, isn't it? Eh? Talk about being subtle.
Text,
there.
Subtext.
So it's supposed to represent, you know, the epitome of small town America. So that in itself is lazy to call a town supposed to represent the heartland of America, Heartland. The other criticism that you had about it being incomprehensible, the Beatles themselves, although they weren't directly hands-on involved, but they acknowledged it, whereas they had nothing to do with this one whatsoever, right? And at the time when this was made, the Beatles had only been broken up for about 8 years officially, and all four were still alive. They tried doing this themselves. They tried creating a narrative out of their songs in the Yellow Submarine cartoon. That was as fun as it is, visually speaking, great characters of Blumies, etc. The story is somewhat incomprehensible. Here, they're trying to do the exact same thing, but without any Beatles involvement, without any creativity, without any sort of whimsical nature that you have in Yellow Submarine. And it just falls flat on every level. Now, many years later, there was a movie called Across the Universe, which I saw in the theater, and that did a better job of tying together a narrative with Beatles songs, but that's because there was dialogue as well, and you need to have, in a musical, this had dialogue, but our protagonist didn't utter one word of dialogue, and there's a very legitimate reason for that, which is an idiotic reason, but I'll explain in a moment. Without the dialogue tied together, you're just trying to get these lyrics to make up a story, a cohesive whole, and then build these set pieces around the songs, and then not have the original singer sing the songs, it's going to come out a mess. Mm-hmm. The Beatles themselves, or those associated with the Beatles, couldn't do with Yellow Submarine, which was a fun movie, don't get me wrong,
sure.
But it wasn't what you would call a masterpiece of comprehensibility. This, on the other hand, was completely just... I can't even... like. A part of me died watching this movie.
Well, I guess ironically, given that it was called Heartland and set in the Heartland and features a band from the town of Heartland who's supposed to be all American, the voices, presumably why they weren't voiced, are Aussies. So,
well, that's exactly, it's not presumably, that's the reason why.
Yeah, so I guess they're incomprehensible accents. Who knows? I've never heard the Brothers Gibb actually speak.
Well,
so,
here we have a band comprised of four members, just like the Beatles. But those four members are the three members of the Bee Gees, the Brothers Gibb. That's what the Bee Gees stand for, by the way, the Brothers Gibb.
Yeah, for sure.
And Peter Frampton. So, Australian musicians that were riding high. It's like the peak of their career. This movie basically destroyed all their career. So, because they're supposed to be residents of Heartland America, literally, the producers felt that they're not going to utter any words because of their accents. Okay, they could have had a dialogue coach, they could have been trained to speak with American accents, they could have dubbed their voices just for a bit of dialogue, but instead they chose to have George Burns as a sort of like god figure, this omniscient narrator. Now, before we even get further into it, because we talked about the Bee Gees and Pierre Frampton, I'm not a big disco fan, okay? Although I will concede that some of the Bee Gees disco stuff is some of the best of the genre. But the Bee Gees are a talented band, and mm-hmm. they have some wonderful songs. They're easy to make fun of in a lot of ways, but they really do have some really good pop songs. Peter Frampton, on the other hand, I have never seen the appeal of Peter Frampton.
Well, it's funny. Mike Myers joked that growing up in the suburbs of Toronto, he thought that Frampton Comes Alive was issued to everyone in 1978 because everyone had it. And yeah, there's that one song that has some voice box guitar.
Yeah,
Do you feel like I do, or whatever?
It's
god awful. He's god awful.
Oh,
the
just,
whole thing is.
You
is,
have this skinny, milquetoast, blonde, moppet headed. Yeah. Some people say he's a great guitar player. In fact, after his career plummeted and he could no longer sell records on his own, he actually joined David Bowie's band as a guitar player.
Huh, I did not know that.
And he wasn't even acknowledged. Just like. And on guitar, Peter Frampton.
So not even yeah. wouldn't even make crack my top five Bowie guitars.
So whereas Peter Frampton had one massive selling album, and that was Frampton Comes Alive, nothing before nor after ever reached those heights. And I don't see how anybody could have ever found the guy appealing in any way.
Yeah. And what's funny is like this is very hastily cobbled together narrative, which I was thinking is basically a Joseph Campbell hero story. You have a group, they must leave their loved ones behind mm-hmm. to seek riches and or success in the big city. They are exploited, so they go into the underworld, and then they emerge triumphant. But that's the only bit that is any way intelligible. But the rest, whatever happens to them during that time, I didn't quite understand.
In the monomyth, Joseph Campbell's monomyth, the hero has a mentor. Somebody older, wiser, who somehow leads them down the straight and narrow.
Uh-huh.
Or at least gives them the power to do it on their own. Was there a mentor in this one? Because otherwise, yes, this was pretty much.
I'm not sure.
yeah. Would you call George Byrne? No.
Not really.
So it lacked a mentor. But other than that, yes, it was the hero's journey. But when you have a musical about the music industry that's criticizing the industry for being so money-hungry and cash-grabbing and what have you, watch Apple. Mm-hmm. The Apple did that and did it so much more entertaining. I mean, yes, the Apple is bastard crazy and also talks about theology and God and the nature of the universe and so on and so forth, but it did it way better than this.
Yeah, and in many ways way worse, because if you're just going to go for the gusto and do something so wrong-headed and so over the top, instead of having instead of having a string quartet, go for the symphony of badness. And that the Apple is so much more vividly terrible mm-hmm. and exciting in a way of how it slipped and how it went
but,
sideways. That's what makes it memorable.
And it's entertaining.
This is not memorable.
It's entertaining.
Yeah.
It's got great songs. It's fun. It's got exuberance to it. I mean, the concept was wrongheaded, but the Apple is
a cult
classic for a reason. This is an infamous flop for a reason.
Yeah, for sure. And you could even cite, Xanadu for the sweetness and mm-hmm. the romantic rapport in the two leads and
yeah.
chemistry. They tried to replicate
and, yep.
that here with
the Warriors.
Billy Shears and Strawberry Fields. And
they
had
strawberry
nothing.
Strawberry Fields, so they call her Strawberry, but of course.
Yeah, like, there's no dramatic tension between the two at all.
No. Because that's because Peter Frampton is like, he's like a cipher. He's just there. Like, even on stage, like, he doesn't. He like disappears.
Mm-hmm.
The BGs.
The OJs would have been better. Yeah.
The BGs.
That would have been badass.
We're okay, but every time Frampton opened up his mouth to sing lead, I wanted to like bore through my eardrums, puncture them. I couldn't listen anymore.
And if there is somewhat of a plot, I guess you could say the evil record company called BD Records. I'm not sure what the BD stands for. If you have any insights into that, they
big deal maybe.
Big
I
deal
think it might
and
have been big deal.
And
yeah.
The top of their roster on their record label is the Evil Band played by Aerosmith. I don't know what they're called. They're called
the FFB or something, which stands for like the FBB, which is like the Future Something Band. They're the Future Band. Yep.
Oh my. Well, considering they were just like any other 70s band at the time, it doesn't seem like much of a future.
Interestingly enough, let me just give you a little... This is something I learned off IMDb. Aerosmith did play the evil Future band that had to be defeated at the hands of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And of course, you know, there are two funny things about this. First of all, Peter Frampton was supposed to end up killing Steven Tyler's character, right? And Tyler said, there is no way that I will be killed by that wuss. So you could find another way to off me. I think he ended up falling off because I started drifting.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, he's. I am not. Too. It's gonna. There's no way that wussy is gonna beat me, right? Mm. Now, of course, this was during Aerosmith's major drug fueled years, the Thompson Twins, etc. They were not the first choice to play the Evil Future Band.
Oh yes, and your favorites were.
Well, they're not my favorites anymore, but Kiss. Kiss was offered the role, and they turned it down, thinking it would hurt their image, right? In a way, you think, well, yeah, it probably would, and good on them for having the foresight to realize that, but they made Kiss Me's The Phantom of the Park instead, which was a freaking Hanna-Barbera kids movie, so I don't know, anyway.
Well, yeah, so they're the top band, and they're, I guess, the rivals, although I don't really see in what context, and evil minions of the record company have been stealing the instruments of the Lonely Hearts Club Band.
The magical instruments, yes.
Yeah, the magical tuba, cornet, which is like a trumpet, which is weird, because not every song really has a horn section. So if they're magical instruments, primarily you think guitar, bass, and drums. Mm. This is the trio that backs up Peter Frampton being the Bee Gees. You think they would be the magical instruments, but that's a minor quibble anyway. I think I got enough horns.
The Bee Gees would be the magical instruments?
The Bee Gees instruments would have been playing the magical instruments, so that made no sense at all. And speaking of instruments, I mean, we were discussing on our walk to the corner store earlier here, like what atrocious performances all the way through. Mm-hmm. I wrote in my notes here, I said, I want you, She's So Heavy. I have Dash, Takes Forever, and you can see I wrote that in caps.
Yeah.
That was agonizing.
Oh my God.
Agonizingly bad.
I Want You, She's So Heavy, is one of my favorite Beatles songs. Mm-hmm. But it's an atypical Beatles song. It's on Abbey Road, it's about 8 minutes, repetitive lyrics, but it's got incredible guitar.
For sure.
Of course you're going to change the arrangement, take out that guitar, and you just have a bunch of characters going, I want you, I want you so bad. I want you so bad. It's driving me mad. Da, 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 da. And whether it was Pleasant singing it or really just sort of speaking it, whether it was the Bee Gees singing it, Frampton, some R&B singers that were known, it just went on and on and on. But there was so much of this movie, it just went on and on and on. It was so interminable with nothing but songs. And these are some of the best songs in the history of recorded music, but they're playing, their renditions are so terrible. Not every single one. I have to keep going back to that.
Well, the second worst one, I would say, is also from Abbey Road. I want to say She Doesn't Give Me Money. I forget the title.
Oh, that was so bad.
And that was sung by Dougie Shears, which is Billy Shears, I think he was evil brother, who was signed to BD Records. Oh, yeah, the evil brother. It's the monomyth. And holy crap, was that bad. And they had, I guess, cut out paper mache dollar signs, and they were dancing on a table, passing dollar signs back and forth. That went on for bloody ever as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are long stretches of film where nothing happens. And again, I mean, you're saying that some of the performances were awful, right?
The bulk of them.
The bulk of them were. But I will say that there were some interesting performances. For example, but it's just not worth slogging your way through this two-hour crap fest to get to them. I'd even rather buy I don't want to buy the soundtrack album, but Come Together. That was that actually was a hit, okay? And that's on Aerosmith's First Greatest Hits compilation. That reached number 21 on the charts.
It's good, but it's not significantly different from the original that it warrants being in here. Mm-hmm. It's a serviceable cover.
Okay.
It's cool to hear Steven Tyler sing it. It's got some good guitar, but it's not altogether different in the way that, like, Got to Get You Into My Life,
that was a hit too,
from Earth, Wind, and Fire, is considerably different
because
from
that was
the Beatles.
The only musical number really that had exuberance to it.
Yeah,
that actually felt like, oh my God, like they're actually not just going through the motions here. This, like, it felt like Earth, Wind, and Fire really wanted to give the best performance they could, and they did. And I would even go so far as to say that most people to this day probably think of that song as an Earth, Wind, and Fire song.
Yeah,
that version gets more radio play than the Beatles' original version.
Off of Revolver. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I really did enjoy the mustachioed Alice Cooper. He sang Because, even though he was sort of playing the Sun King, you know, so he should have sang the Sun King, and that's also from the Abbey Road. And there's this other weird little thing, and he's in cahoots with the record label or something, and he's creating this group of mindless drones, and they have this this motto saying, we hate love, we hate joy, we love money, and they're here and then they're gone, right? But Cooper was good. A sinister version of Because. I liked it. I enjoyed George Burns singing
with Fixin' the Hole.
Because he brought up his vaudeville charm to it. Why didn't you? You said,
well, I like the number. It was maybe the only good dance number because, again, that She Never Gives Me Money or God Knows What with Dougie Shears. It was an awful set piece. It was poorly choreographed. Everything was poorly choreographed. There was nothing crisp. And if you want to compare it to the Apple, at least they went all out with the dance numbers.
It's funny they were comparing to the Apple when the Beatles were called
the
Apple.
Well, it's also funny that is just a notorious misguided flop, and it looks like Citizen Kane compared to this.
Yeah.
So, I would say the nadir. So I cited my top two worst. This has to be in the top is Barry Gibb warbling in the final 10 minutes, A Day in the Life.
Oh.
It was just absolutely painful. Just a part of your soul just slips away.
One of the things about the Beatles, and one of the reasons why I love them so much, besides writing some of the most phenomenal melodies in popular music, but their arrangements, I mean, they were so intricate, were so beyond what anybody else was doing at the time. I mean, you know, as everyone knows, they were treated from touring to become a studio band so they can do all this experimentation.
Oh, yeah, rivaled only by Hendrix and Floyd, really, but not even, maybe unrivaled.
So they're taking these wonderful arrangements, like A Day in the Life, which is just incredible. You know, considering they were only using four tracks back then, unbelievable. You know, of course, George Martin, the producer, I mean, he's like pretty much a fifth Beatle. And they're changing it to these milquetoast, like, Muzak, elevator music, version. So when you hear A Day in the Life, which is probably the crowning song on Sgt. Pepper, the album, sung in this terrible way, with these, and the same as Strawberry Fields Forever. You got this milquetoast, tepid Muzak in the back, when really, I think Strawberry Fields Forever is almost like a precursor to every form of recorded music today.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of everything in it. There's a little bit of electronica, trip-hop, ambient, this, that, rock. It's incredible. But what they did with it in this is sacrilegious. I do want to mention another performance I like, though. Steve Martin.
Ooh.
He played Dr. Maxwell, and he sang Maxwell Silverhammer, as only Steve Martin could do. Now, you can't.
As only he's done a bunch of times.
Well, he's a song and SNL, dance, man, and you know.
It's part of his stage act.
Yeah, but really, what? Because he was a...
It was like a King Tut kind of thing. Right?
Exactly. But he was sort of like an evil plastic surgeon. So in many ways, it was almost like a dress rehearsal for Little Shop of Horrors.
I was thinking that, yeah.
10 years later, where he was going to play like an evil...
Evil dentist.
Yeah. Orthodontist or dentist. So I enjoyed that. I guess I enjoyed more of the non-traditional renditions, but the ones that were supposed to be traditional, I just despised. And again, how can you take some of my absolute favorite songs and make me hate them?
Yeah, Get Back as well. The very, very campy Billy Preston.
Oh,
who it was amazing to me that his sexuality was always undercover.
I did not know this.
Keith Richards in his Life book, which is excellent, by
which
the way.
Which I read. I don't recall.
Billy Preston struggled with his... It didn't look like he was struggling here. He was fine with it here. He was whooping it up in high camp fashion,
okay,
doing
well, let me just
Get Back. Thing. And yeah.
And I'm sorry, it's because I'm such a Beatles fan, right? And that's why I'm probably jumping a lot here. Of every participant in this film, the only one that had any actual connection to the Beatles, I think George Martin did help.
George Martin was involved in this,
and not shameful. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That you know, he allowed his arrangements to become what it became. It was Billy Preston. Billy Preston played with the Beatles on the song Get Back. He played organ, he played on a couple other tracks that were on the Let It Be record, which I think is an extremely underrated record. In this one, he's singing Get Back solo, so in other words, he's not just playing the organ or singing background, and he's singing it like he's singing Zippity Doodah.
Yeah.
He's so...
Oh,
my God. Yeah. And the character he's playing, he's given no introduction. They don't say what he is.
Yeah, zero context.
He's a deus ex machina.
Mm-hmm.
Is he supposed to be God?
I'm not sure.
Because he basically saves the day just by snapping his fingers a couple times. And then we get the finale. And that finale was something else. But before we describe the finale, was there anything else you wanted to mention about the plot, the songs?
Well, no, it just, considering they didn't want to use any of the original voices or accents and had to have Mr. Kite, George Burns, string everything together as the narrator, and he just becomes this gravel-voiced vaudeville Mr. Exposition man.
Yeah.
Because there's no cohesive thread. He just comes in and said, well, the very next day, those boys were, like, it might as well have been Dukes of Hazzard. Like, it was ridiculous.
Those damn Duke boys.
Really, nothing to hold any of this together. Like, I felt kind of wronged in a way and sad, and I wish it was that someone had interceded. Like Paul with all his millions could have stepped in and said, look, put a stop to this, or at least given it a guiding hand. This needed major oversight.
Oh, and we haven't even mentioned, I mean, this movie's so chock full with stupidity that we haven't even mentioned the spaceship and the robots. The singing robots. Controlled by Mean Mr. Mustard, which is, of course, another Beatles song.
Oh, yeah. Or even the tie into Yellow Submarine with the hot air balloons.
Yep.
Which was totally pointless. Mm-hmm. And you have these awful polyester outfits and these guys all bedecked in them and jumping into these. And then it's for what, right? I don't understand how they would be transported from Heartland to there. That was supposed to be the whimsy derived from the aforementioned Beatles thing that just... And how can you not have whimsy when you have a hot air balloon?
Have Beatles songs.
Like Baron von Munchausen. But there's no whimsy.
Exactly. Except for when, I guess... And that's why it's not whimsy, but exuberance. With Earth, Wind & Fire. But you're right, there's no whimsy. And it should be. There's colorful sets. There's colorful costumes. There's great songs, you know, that you could do good stuff with. This should have been... Well, no. I was going to say this should have been a rousing success. But all the elements in place ensure that it wouldn't be. Particularly the casting of the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. Because, and I'm thinking to myself, why in God's name would they have accepted this role, both the Bee Gees and Frampton? Because what you're doing is you are automatically setting yourself up for failure, because you are forcing people to pair you to what is considered to be the greatest rock and roll band ever, or at least one of the most innovative, or at least one of the most influential. So everything they do is going to pale by comparison, because they're the stars and they're singing most of the songs. They're the ones that are going to take the brunt of the criticism. Sure, people laugh, oh, George Burns singing Fixing a Hole, but, you know, it's a novelty number. And of course, even Steve Martin, novelty number. But when you have legitimate musicians coming off their career highs deciding to do this, and then it being the flop that it was, and their careers never really fully recovering. Well, the Bee Gees did come back, but not Peter Frampton.
Well, that's weird, too, because their popularity was at its apex. So you would have thought they would have injected some huge disco into this, which they might have been excoriated for doing so. But playing it safe...
Because the Bee Gees were never a disco band, right? They were always a pop band. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of segued into a disco band for Saturday Night Fever, and because it was so massive, people just can assume that they were a disco band. That's what they would be for the rest of their career. But the Bee Gees themselves were not happy being associated with disco and disco only. So I think they wanted to go right back to their roots, which was more pop, rock, etc.
Well, if they had just at least taken that tack, I mean, you can think of your favorite covers, none of which are very similar to the originals. So why would you effectively not reboot the entire album in your own style, or get people to do so?
But see,
so
that's
if you're
why
only
going like,
to have Earth, Wind & Fire do a R&B rave up of a Beatles song, that's great.
That's why I like Cooper's because he does it in his style. It's sinister.
I guess, yeah.
That's why I like Burns and Martin, you know, the non-singers, because it's something unique. It's something different. It's a bit of a novelty, but it works for me. Anything that was sung by anybody else was terrible. Billy Preston himself did no favors to a song he's one of the most famous for, Get Back.
Oh, God, and Nowhere Man went nowhere. That was another just awful, like another just really pretty song. And just a absolute disaster.
She's Leaving Home was one of the most beautiful songs off the Sgt. Pepper album. One of the most poignant songs was practically sung by those robots.
Yeah. Robotic
Doors.
Yeah, well, that's why I didn't recognize it.
Oh, my Lord.
But even Earth, Wind & Fire, so that's one of the few bright spots. When they descended on stage, it was like Spinal Tap trying to emerge from those encasements. That was terrible. So even that was ruined. The whole thing was very strange.
So let me tell you a funny anecdote, because you were saying about the Beatles, like, couldn't somebody step in and do something? And they just couldn't be bothered at this point, right? I guess they just wanted the check, and that was the end of that, right?
Yeah, I guess, well, Paul would have been busy with Wings and everyone else doing their own thing.
Well, Ringo was, he could have done something. What was Ringo ever up to? No one knows. But poor John Lennon. This is an anecdote I read when I was researching after watching this movie. He was subjected to this god-awful movie twice on a plane. On the way there, and on the way back. And he was... not a happy man. He was not a happy man the first time, and the second time I don't think he was Thank God there weren't air marshals back then, because who knows what that would have done. Now, the finale was incredible, because, again, they're singing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. But in a very, I want to say subtle, but because they were, it's not subtle at all, because the filmmakers just didn't know how to really make anything convincingly represent what was supposed to represent. In a nod to the Sgt. Pepper album cover, they want to have all these cameos of different stars, right? Because that's what was the cover of the record. They had all, you know, this wonderful collage with Mae West and Bob Dylan and so on, and Muhammad Ali, et cetera, et cetera. So they tried to round up a whole bunch of celebrities, and each and every person in that rendition, that We Are the World rendition of Sgt. Pepper, was a celebrity, but I could only recognize a few, and I was actually writing down the ones I remembered. I recognize Wolfman Jack. So these are all D-list celebrities. Dame Edna, Dame Edna, Tina Turner. Now, I'll talk about that in a moment or two, because when I say Tina Turner D-list, that probably makes people go, no, she's a superstar, but hold on. Carol Channing, Edgar Winter, albino, you know,
yeah.
And Shanana, as well as a whole bunch of people that I truly did not recognize. Now, very quick story about Tina Turner. My mother, massive fan of Tina Turner, always has been, okay? When Tina broke away from Ike, she spent years and years and years trying to get herself back to the top of the music business. Ike said, "You'd be nothing without me," and for many years, it was true. And my mother, as a fan of Tina from the very beginning, my mother was a fan through Tina's entire career, she said that in the late 70s, around this time when this movie was filmed, she was in the Catskills. Right, which is sort of like, how would you describe the Catskills? It's upstate New York. It's like a resort.
Yeah, resort area where like cheesy comics go to perform. Yeah. Like.
And she said that Tina Turner was performing a show there. Tina Turner. The Tina Turner. And there were about 7 people in the audience. And she said Tina Turner came out and played as if there was 70,000. She gave it her all. So when she finally came back in 84 with What's Love Got to Do with It, she earned every moment of her comeback and her reemergence to superstardom. But at this point, she was in a low ebb in her career. This is when she probably would have played that concert in the Catskills to 7 people.
Wow. All right, now we can segue into what we've learned, because we've learned a lot. Should I go first?
Sure.
Well, I read that, I guess, Peter Frampton was involved in a car crash around the time he was meant to promote this.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was off the hook, I guess, recovering and recuperating. Also, I learned that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was meant to be a soundtrack smash a la Grease, one of these big musicals. But when they played versions of this on the radio, angry listeners would phone in and demand to hear the originals.
The original.
It goes to show, when the 45 of Earth, Wind, and Fire's Got to Get You Into My Life came out, that was a bona fide
hit,
because the original was sort of an obscure track off Revolver, so not a big hit. So that was understandably a hit, plus it's cool and has horns and is all fun and funky. The rest of them, it was like, get me out of here, I want the original.
Well, like I said,
Come Together
did hit number 21 on rock radio, and it was considered a minor hit for Aerosmith.
So what did you learn?
So I was going to say that a musical needs dialogue to propel the plot, but we talked about that. You can't just have wall-to-wall songs. Even on Broadway, you know, you go see Les Mis, there's a little bit of dialogue, just a tiny bit here and there. And so to have this omniscient narrator, it didn't work. What else did I learn? I learned that the 70s and the early 80s were a time for lots and lots of musicals in the cinema, and most of them, with the exception of the aforementioned Grease and so on and so forth, were infamous flops, but were thoroughly entertaining and have come back and have been rediscovered, and legions of fans are just clamoring for them, such as Xanadu, the aforementioned Xanadu. People are putting on stage recreations of Xanadu. Even Rocky Horror was a bit of a flop until somebody had the brilliant idea to start doing midnight screenings. But they kept turning these out. This is the worst of the worst. I mean, those musicals from the late 70s, early 80s, they may not have done well at the box office, but they are charming, exuberant, wonderful. This is a complete slog. This is something that should be used to torture those suspected of domestic terrorism.
Oh yeah.
That's how bad this movie is. And I'm not in favor of torture. I'm just saying, you know, yeah. in order to get
and,
some.
And this was a coke-fueled production as well. Although
and
the
Bee Gees
out-
complained about that, actually. Uh-huh. And the Bee Gees, they said they blamed this production for exacerbating their addictions.
Well, yeah, and perpetuating the downfall through alcoholism. And it's funny, Alice Cooper was in rehab during the time he was in this movie. But
actually, he got offset when he was done finishing and went straight to rehab.
Ooh.
But instead of going into rehab, he took himself into a sanitarium. And they fixed him up a little bit, but then he had to go back into rehab years later to become the fully sober Alice Cooper we know and love today.
Well,
so yeah, I mean, there's a lot... a lot that we've learned. This movie. Oh, and I just want to say one last thing. This was a movie that our dearly departed. I mean, it's still on TV, but it's not what it used to be. City TV used to play often late at night, and I would flip through and I'd flip past it, and I'd go back and I would watch. Let's say, Aerosmith singing "Come Together," and I'd be like, "Yeah, that's interesting." But then, as soon as the Bee Gees appear, Phantom would come on, and I'd be like, "This is terrible," and I would just switch it immediately. But when this was suggested for us to do, I was excited to revisit. I thought, you know what? I'm probably, because my initial reaction to Xanadu was, I don't know if I'm going to like that. I've heard nothing but bad things about it. It's henceforth become one of my
favorite
movies.
Also, our antipathy toward Olivia Newton-John.
I don't have that anymore. I love her.
Yeah, true.
I did before Xanadu. Yeah. Now I worship her. After seeing that movie, how could you not? Mm-hmm. You know, she's a goddess. But anyway, I thought that reassessing this movie all these years later, I would enjoy it. It just made me thoroughly depressed. So I'm going to give this... Well, I would have said a half star, which is really... But because of those performances I did like, I'm going to give it 1 star.
Oh, God. When you mentioned the robots and that indecipherable Beatles song, I don't even know what that
which
was.
Which is one of the most beautiful songs that Paul has ever written.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize it. These weird robots... piloting that mustard
they
van.
Look like they look like the robot butler on the Jetsons. Was Rosie or whatever.
Yeah, that was really grim, rough stuff. History has not been kind. I was really in the mood for something fun,
so
and it's good that you can excavate something that's been relegated to the dustbins of pop culture, but that was not the case here. So sad, very sad. 3/4 star for me.
You remind me of the American president at that moment.
Oh my God! Yeah, almost the tweet. What isn't sad is the often.
Well, what
always,
is sad is the American president.
The always exuberant is... and not sad. Really awful movies podcast uploaded for your listening pleasure every Friday. New episodes. Thank you for the suggestions that came through on Facebook on musicals we should cover. We're gonna revisit this genre soon. We will talk to you soon too.
Take care. Thank you.